Let's do it. Yeah.
Main man.
Main man.
Main man.
Main man.
Main man. I was once described as the manager, the mentor, and the visionary who went to the theatre with an unfocused dilettante and raised the curtain on a superstar.
Hello and welcome. This is episode 46 in our series exploring the history of Main Man, the management rights company which was renowned in the 70s for transforming the business of rock and roll. The Main Man ethos was to provide funding that enabled their artists to fully explore their creative freedom while pioneering outrageous and often controversial promotions and marketing techniques that became synonymous with the decadence, extravagance and indulgences that are now part of rock folklore.
The drug was speed. All these people, especially around the factory, they took speed. They were very fast-talking, witty, quick with the put-down, vicious, very, very vicious.
Main Man worked with a diverse range of clients that included David Bowie, Amanda Lear, Mick Ronson, John Mellencamp, Mott the Hoople, Danica Gillespie, Mick Ralphs, Iggy Pop, Marianne Faithfull, and Lou Reed.
If you check the lyrics out in retrospect, you'll see just how funny I am. There are puns and jokes in there. It's not unrelieved tension. Although I like tension in songs.
In this episode, as Main Man founder Tony DeFries continues with his highlights of 1971, 50 years after he accompanied David Bowie to New York to sign a new deal with RCA Records, it's a great time for Tony to explain some of the unique history of the companies he researched back in the day as part of his process to find a suitable partner to highlight Bowie's undiscovered talent.
Many people are completely unaware of how record companies operate, and particularly how they operated in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and in many ways still operate today. So this post-war music industry period, it appeared that these record companies were part of a loosely structured, privately operated, small community with a Wild West frontier mentality. But underlying that appearance of EMI and CBS and RCA and the other players is a slightly different picture. Each of these record companies that we call the majors, so we're talking about CBS, we're talking about RCA, we're talking about EMI, Philips, which became Polygram, and we're talking about BMG. These are record companies that belong to enormous conglomerates, global media, technology, electronics businesses. And those businesses almost always engaged, although many of them were 100 years old, in the industrial engineering and electrical and radio and television businesses. They were also engaged in the defense and military industrial complex of the particular countries and very often of other countries in which they operated. That means that when you look at a company like EMI or Decca Records, what you see is a record company. What you don't always see and very rarely see is what else that company were engaged in. So, for example, CBS Records was a record company and a networking company for radio and television, but deeply concealed in all of that were the CBS Laboratories, also known as the CBS Technology Center. And there, technology was researched and developed for industrial, military, and consumer technologies, very many of them groundbreaking discoveries. Columbia Records was originally called, merged with various other companies, at one point was partnered with EMI and had the Radio Corporation of America, i.e. RCA, as a majority shareholder. In 1929, RCA effectively owned 50%, and that gave David Sarnoff, who was a chairman of RCA, a seat on the EMI board. this process gets very complicated after a while. What you see is that when we look at EMI Records, famously formed in 1931 and opened the recording studios at Abbey Road in London during that time, that was a year in which it was also operating as a research company. So eventually you have an EMI, which now has rights to the Columbia name and various logos along with it, and has His Master's Voice record label, so this is HMV's record label, and it's involved in electronics and electrical engineering, which includes, for example, the invention of stereophonic sound in 1931, and the inventor of that, Alan Blumlein, was killed in 1942 whilst he was conducting trials, in-flight trials, on an experimental radar. So during and after World War II, the EMI laboratories in Hayes in the UK developed radar equipment for the British Army, microwave devices for the Admiralty, and eventually guided missiles employing analog computers. AMIHUS Electronics was based in Scotland, owned 51% by Hughes Aircraft of California and 49% by EMI. It manufactured a variety of electronic products, including, in the mid-1970s, handheld calculators that featured liquid crystal displays. In the 1940s, Philips Research had a lab in, or many labs actually, in Eindhoven, and they combined various music businesses that they had stakes in or owned into Philips Phonogram or Phonographic Industries, PPI, which was a wholly owned subsidiary of the electronics business. At one point, they planned a merger with Decca of London, but that was rejected. A second attempt was made with Deutsche Grammophon, which was owned by Siemens AG, and it also owned Polydor Records. This led to a merger, which ultimately produced Polygram. Philips was founded in 1891 by a father and son, Philips, and their first products were light bulbs. It became the largest producer of light bulbs in the world, and eventually created a multinational electronics entity in the form of the Philips Corporation. So we begin to see a pattern emerging where every major record company is really an electronics company or an engineering company, and all of them are engaged in some way with weapons or with devices like radar or sonar that will be weaponized. Deutsche Grammophon, DGG, was founded in 1898 by a German-born United States citizen called Emil Berliner and was the German branch of the Berliner Grammophon Company. They became the affiliate of the US Victor Talking Machine Company, RCA, and the British Grammophon Company. But when the war broke out in 1914, that's the First World War, that affiliation ended. But although there was no longer a connection to the British Grammophon Company, Deutsche Grammophon continued to use the HMV voice trademark, His Master's Voice trademark, featuring the dog Nipper in Germany until the late 1940s. In 1941, Deutsche Grammophon was purchased by Siemens, the electronics company. And of course, Siemens is now one of the largest electronics and industrial defense companies in the world. Skipping forward to the early 70s, after the Beatles had formally broken up and three of them had come under the management wing of Alan Klein, George Harrison made a number of solo albums. And one day we got a call from George, who was very, very disturbed and upset, because he discovered that EMI, which was still releasing the individual Beatles albums under their revised contract, courtesy of Alan, were actually involved in the missile business. And he was horrified at the thought that his record was going to come out, albeit the Beatles records had already come out, on this label that had another occupation, namely building weapons. And he wanted us to stop it from being released. And we said, well, you know, George, there isn't really any basis legally for suggesting that they can't release the record, especially the already released and shipped records galore, simply because you've now discovered that they were involved in, and possibly still are involved in, defense weaponry or military supplies or any kind of military connection, because it doesn't give you a right to say, I want my record back. And it took quite a long while after that before we did get free, or George got free, we got George free, I should say, of EMI, and he became entirely independent. But he was not happy about the fact. I mean, George was very much a pacifist, in some ways an activist for pacifism, and very opposed to the idea that the company that was selling his records might also be engaged in selling weaponry. Almost every company that was engaged in recorded sound had some connection to the technology that could be used. RCA, as the Radio Corporation of America, has a long and checkered history, and one of the most important figures was David Sarnoff. The legend goes that David Sarnoff was a telegraph operator at the RCA telegraph station in New York, and was there the night that the Titanic encountered an iceberg and began to sink. A ship that was within range of the Titanic, which was not itself equipped with a full wireless telegraph system, but had a more limited version, picked up a signal from the Titanic and relayed it to a number of stations around the world as an SOS. When the station that Sarnoff was at received the message, he remained at his telegraph post and keyed out the same message for many, many, many hours. But the entire duration of the Titanic sinking, Sarnoff was engaged in making sure that the message reached as many people as possible. This became an early victory for radio in America, for RCA in particular, and for radio development worldwide. Now, of course, RCA were already a major customer and supplier, of course, of the military-industrial complex, not just in America, but in other countries as well. They were deeply involved in the development of electronics, and they became interested in the idea of moving images. Before there was television, and remember, television as a form was invented almost simultaneously, within a few years of each other, by a Scottish chap called Logie Baird, by an Italian chap called Marconi, and by an American chap with the unlikely name of Zsigmondzi, starting with a Z. Zsigmondzi was the inventor who caught Sarnoff's attention, and Sarnoff saw a demonstration, a very early form of, from the RCA labs, of a moving image on a screen. And he then, in the same way that he'd commandeered purchasing microphones and microphone companies and microphone patents globally to make RCA and NBC leaders in the field of broadcasting, and you can see microphones from that era, we're talking about the 40s and the 50s, maybe even earlier 30s, where microphones very often begin to resemble each other. That's because NBC essentially, or RCA / NBC, cornered the market on microphones. This is something that Sarnoff was very accomplished at, is identifying a market, identifying a product, and then encompassing as much of it as quickly as possible. So he wanted to do that with television for NBC. And to do that, he needed to devote a lot of funds and a lot of people to the build-out of commercial television. And that was achieved through another company that they created called Zenith. And they rapidly became the leading player in the production of television sets, and not just television receivers, i.e. your TV set, but television cameras, television transmitters, and television stations. Hence, when the idea of television became a national, federal occupation, which it quickly did, he was ready to step up and demand the National Broadcasting Company get a franchise in American television. This was enormously important because there are only three franchises granted for nationwide television broadcasting and, by definition, development of broadcast material in America, and those three became NBC, CBS, and ABC. They became what were known as national network broadcasting companies because they had an FCC license that made it possible for them to build transmitting facilities or license transmitting facilities and create a national broadcast network of television, which meant they could immediately start making their own programs, their own material for television. So they became essentially film and television companies almost overnight. That brings us to the story of what I always call a bad day at BlackRock. The CBS building, which was the CBS corporate building and housed CBS television, CBS film, CBS corporate, and CBS records, was a building, a skyscraper made of metals, probably aluminum, steel, lots of black glass. The result of the black glass was that it was generally called BlackRock. And the title of a movie made called Bad Day at BlackRock encouraged me to think of this story. During the 1960s, and probably starting in the 50s, reports began to circulate privately at the FCC and later publicly that the licenses that had been granted to these three major broadcasters were being influenced by criminal elements who wanted to essentially dictate what products, what material, what brands would be featured on what stations. Remember that the stations are always local affiliates because signals weren't yet capable of being broadcast over such a vast area that you could have one station broadcast to the nation. So the entire country had been separated into different areas, each one providing a television signal, and each one therefore providing a transmission capability on many transmission stations, which opportuned the possibility, just as radio stations did, for criminal elements to do the work of essentially subverting what was played and where. The rumours and the concerns arrived at a point where the Federal Communications Commission felt that they needed to make a sort of public demonstration of the honesty of broadcasting and the honesty of television. And as such, they asked a state district attorney to open an investigation, which led to a grand jury being created to essentially find, or if you like, search and destroy the possibility of national radio and television being tainted by criminal elements. Now, what was going on here was that If you were a record company and you wanted to get your record played on radio stations throughout America, you know, a lot of stations to deal with hundreds of different radio stations, it had become a practice, and it was well entrenched, that if you could get the DJ, or better yet, the program director at a station, to take on a new recording or a new artist and play their records in some kind of rotation that would benefit the record company, you also had to offer the radio station an inducement. Why would they do this? They might do it because they were getting time paid for by advertisers, and the advertiser was essentially saying, I'd like you to feature this record before and after my ad. So I'm going to give you the advertising money, but it comes with this string attached. There were other strings, like if I give you a certain amount of a narcotic substance, you will play this record a certain number of times. If it becomes a weekly delivery of some narcotic substance or money, then you'll play the record a number of times in that week and so on. This is a process that was actually started much earlier and investigated much earlier in the aerospace industry. And it was the fact that Howard Hughes was being investigated, and I think it was back in the 40s, for his Hughes Tool Company, which was building aircraft, supplying aircraft, where the suggestion was that he was paying off federal contractors, people who were in the position to give him a federal contractor, and other large players, other big industry players, by inviting them to participate in marketing events for Hughes products and providing assorted inducements in the form of money and sex and drugs and other things that would make it more attractive for them to give this contract to a Hughes tool player than another player. Not to say that other companies weren't doing the same thing, because they were, but he and what were then Transworld Airlines, which has since gone out of business, but TWA were an enormously successful airline at the time, and they had a dispute with Hughes because he was busy creating an airline of his own. This was a practice that was already quite common in America, and it got to be called payola. Pay for play is another way of describing that. Now, CBS had a license from the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, which could be removed, it could be suspended, but it had to be renewed on a regular basis. It wasn't a license forever, it was a license for a time frame, usually a year. Usually it was renewed automatically without a problem. But now, all of a sudden, the FCC were presented with the possibility, through a whistleblower or two, that CBS Records, which was a branch of the CBS Corporation that was also CBS Radio and Television, were making payments in the form of bribes or arranging for prostitution or arranging for drug deliveries, all bribery of some sort, to radio stations in America. And this became an enormous problem at BlackRock, because whereas the record company was on the lower floors and Clive had his own complete floor on 31, the serious owners and the serious executives of this business inhabited the upper floors. And they didn't want to be punished, but they had to offer up somebody. And they couldn't offer up a lowly employer, because all that he would say was, well, I did it once or twice, but I couldn't have been doing it nationwide. I didn't have that sort of control. They didn't want to offer up, obviously, a major executive of CBS or CBS Television. So they opted for the record company to be the sacrificial lamb. And because they needed the record company to be not just the scapegoat, but a reliable scapegoat, a scapegoat that they could show had its own operation that wasn't controlled by the broadcasting and the film businesses, but was controlled by the record company business. They had to pick a realistic candidate for that role, and they chose Clive, because Clive Davis was the head of CBS Records. From one day to the next, Clive quit his post at CBS, and his entire office, which occupied the entire floor of the 31st floor of this building, was removed in a single day. It simply ceased to exist. Clive, of course, went on to have a very successful career with Arista and with other record companies, and signed up many other artists over time. But that story, coming on in 1973, just 1 year after I'd made deals for Motley Hoople and Iggy Pop with CBS, and all of a sudden, because those deals were always made with Clive, he simply vanishes. But then, or about a year later, he reappears with a brand new Arista record company financed by BMG. And that turned out to be a very successful label, which he later sells to BMG. And that's another story.
Another of Tony Dufresne's fascinating insights into the rarefied and very mysterious backroom workings of record companies back when he was negotiating a new licensing deal for David Bowie 50 years ago that successfully provided the platform for David to become Bowie. There are some great pieces of memorabilia from this period in rock history that are part of an ever-growing archive of Main Man documents, including articles, telexes, letters, and production notes. A lot of them never seen before, that we're adding to the Main Man label website each week. It's a great record of a very exciting period in rock history. That's at mainmanlabel.com. And on the website, you can also check out the other episodes in the Main Man series. I'm Des Shaw. This is a Zinc Media MM Tech production. Thanks for listening.